First thing on our agenda today is we have a legislative draft, LC 1670, that we need to introduce as a committee bill. This, I think, would probably be referred to as the bankruptcy bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
I move that LC 1670 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Brown has moved that LC 1670 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
We have copies of it.
Should be in your packet. It's one of the shortest bills you'll ever see. Not that it would stay that way, but... Any other discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, so ordered. I believe there was an interest in some testimony being given as it relates to some comments that were made earlier on House Bill 2004, and I believe that was by Greg Hartman wanted to come back up, so I didn't think that would take very long, so we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2004, or a work session on 2004, for the purposes of allowing him to bring up that testimony so we can receive that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to state publicly that, and for the record, that when I was president of the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association, I hired Mr.
Hartman.
Thank you, Greg Hartman, in that capacity.
Well, thank you. We won't hold that against you, and we appreciate that you put that on the record, and I'm sure Mr. Hartman appreciated the work. So, right, now that we've got that on the record, I think that's we can move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Greg Hartman. I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I did have the opportunity to respond to Mr. Gary's comments in writing, and I know you all have copies of that letter, so I'm not going to go through that letter. I trust that you will read it at your convenience, and of course, if you have questions, I would be happy to answer them. I want to make just a couple of very, very quick points. Much of Mr. Gary's position is founded on the decision recently made by Judge Lipscomb in Marion County Circuit Court. I think there are a couple of obvious dangers in placing too much reliance upon that decision. The most obvious, of course, is that it is subject to appeal, and as a matter of fact, is on appeal, and so clearly is not the last word on the topics addressed by Judge Lipscomb. The other thing that I think I wanted to make clear in the letter, and if I didn't, I want to emphasize at this point, is that Judge Lipscomb addressed a different set of issues, legal issues, than those which will be addressed when there is an effort to change the current plan. The two cases I cited to you, the Hughes case and the Oregon State Police case, both of which are Supreme Court cases, were both cases which addressed changes. In the Hughes case, it was a legislative change which changed the taxing of PERS benefits. In the OSP case, it was Measure 8, the initiative, which changed certain aspects of the plan. So the reason I called those to your attention was because they will form the basis for any analysis of whether a change in the system is consistent or not consistent with contract rights. In contrast, with what Judge Lipscomb was doing was not addressing a change because there was no change before the court. What Judge Lipscomb was addressing was, in essence, whether the board had correctly interpreted existing statutes and whether the practices of the board were consistent with those statutes. So in other words, the task before Judge Lipscomb was quite different than the task that will be undertaken in a court which analyzes any changes made by the legislature. And that's why I made the point that the issue of individual contract rights was not directly before Judge Lipscomb, because again, his focus was what do these statutes mean, has the PERS board in fact interpreted them correctly, and secondly, has the conduct of the PERS board been consistent with those statutes. As I said, I think the Supreme Court cases I cited to you are the more relevant cases when you're talking about how change will be addressed. And I'd like to just read one sentence, if I may, from the Oregon State Police Officer's case. And it's from that portion of the case where the court determined that it was inappropriate to require participants in PERS and other pension systems to pay 6% of their income, even though they may have made arrangements to have that picked up. And let me read you a sentence which I think goes to the heart of the court's analysis. The statutory pension system and the relationship between the state and its employees clearly established a contractual obligation to provide an undiminished level of benefits at a fixed cost. That was one of the key sentences. The court found that the changes, in fact, offended that basic principle. I think as you go through this process, and you obviously this is not the last bill you will consider on this issue, but as you go through this process, I would ask you to keep in mind that at the end of the day, in other words, when we look at the total work of this legislature in this area, and we all know because we've discussed this before, that that work product will be challenged in the courts by someone, perhaps by many people. The court will be looking at the total work product, a very different approach than you're taking here in this committee. And I'm not being critical of your approach in this committee. It may be very appropriate for legislative action, but the point I simply want to emphasize is at the end of the day, the court will look at the whole package. And I think that the court will apply the standards, unless the court can be convinced some new standards are appropriate, of the cases I cited to you. And as I said, I just wanted to call that one sentence to your attention, because if, in fact, at the end of the day, there has been a substantial diminishment in the benefits that are going to be paid out from PERS, then you're going to have to be able to explain to the court, or DOJ will, because they will end up defending this, why that's consistent with the court's analysis. So I'm not going to go through the letter I sent. As I said, I would be happy to answer any questions if any of you have questions. And again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to make these few comments.
Any questions? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hartman, it's kind of like I'm hesitating to ask this question, but I feel like I have to. As we consider what's going on, we see the state and a number of municipalities are heading for bankruptcy under the current way that PERS is functioning for Tier 1. You may not agree with that, but we feel that this is a very serious concern in years ahead unless something is done. What I'm hearing you say is that nothing really can be done because we have unilateral contracts that are in place and we're stuck with them no matter what. When we talked before, I think you said that once it is made, it cannot be taken back. Because I talked to you about can it ever come down, you said absolutely not. With your wealth of knowledge, what would you do to protect the integrity of the financial integrity of our state and the municipalities, and still provide reasonable benefits to the employers, to the employees of the state?
Representative Richardson, I will give you some suggestions. I wish I had a silver bullet. I don't. We recognize, and when I say we, I mean my clients, the PERS Coalition, recognize the financial difficulties. We've not made light of them. As you can appreciate, they impact my clients as well because they are looking at the potential of many years without raises and things of that nature, so we're very concerned about them. And I wish I could tell you there was some magic way to do this without offending those principles and still save money. I would make this suggestion, and it's a suggestion I made before, that I think what you're going to have to do is if you are going to make substantial changes in the system, and clearly those are going to be considered. I don't know how this whole process will eventually resolve itself. You're going to have to consider whether there is a different theory for the protection of pension benefits, which it would be reasonable to urge the Supreme Court to adopt, given the current circumstances, which is different, or at least more flexible, perhaps, than the standard which the court has currently adopted. In other words, I don't think you can legislate in a vacuum without almost working backwards and saying to yourself, at the end of the day, when DOJ has to go before the Supreme Court and defend the package that we have produced, what is going to be the rationale, which may or may not be acceptable to the court, but at least a solid rationale for why it makes sense to do this and why there is nonetheless a consistent, adequate protection of the benefits of members. That's really the best suggestion I can make. Now, there is one example out there, and you'll recall the PERS Board and their deliberations on this same topic of actuarial equivalencies, and they've not completed this process, but seem to have gone from the the theory of unilateral contract, which I pointed out to you, to the theory of accrued benefits. And you'll recall that the material, I think I discussed it the last time I was here, the material that they have developed is an approach which they seem to have borrowed from the private sector, and they seem to be saying that as long as we protect accrued benefits, we believe that's an adequate protection of benefits. Now, the Supreme Court has not as yet said they would adopt it, but it is a logical place to go. May or may not be acceptable to the court. I mean, that's kind of anybody's guess. But for instance, I think that is a principled way of addressing the problem because they have come up with a formulation which can be argued. But if you don't approach it in that way, I'm troubled that at the end of the day, if there's simply no unifying principle that can be taken to the court to say this is a adequate way of doing this, then you really leave the court with no place to go. So I wish I could give you a better silver bullet, but that's probably the most constructive suggestion I can make.
I think it's a good suggestion and certainly does give a framework. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions, Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we've got Gary here and the attorneys that are here at the dais, I'd like to just have a brief response relative to the concern that I have of a doctrine that I seem to recall from years and years ago, and that's called impossibility to perform. We're dealing with a liability that's appears to be about the equivalent of about 3 years worth of general fund, maybe more, and it would appear that if we shut down all of the state government and a lot of local government, that's the only way we could perform, and then that makes it an impossibility to perform because there'd be total chaos that would reign. I just need to have some feeling as to how we back ourselves into a corner and don't have the ability to perform on a $15.7 billion liability.
Representative Butler, if I may, I don't share, although I share the concern and my clients share the concern about the financial challenges, I don't necessarily agree that they are quite as dire as you make them out to be. But then again, that's just a difference of opinion. There exists a doctrine of impossibility that continues to, you can go look it up in the books and it's still there, it hasn't gone anywhere. But I think the challenge here is that you have a contract which is protected both under the state and federal constitution by the doctrine of preventing the impairment of contract. And I think the court's analysis is going to be under those paragraphs rather than necessarily going to an impossibility analysis. And my further concern is if, and this relates not so much to the specifics of the financial difficulties of PERS, but if the state and local governments have gotten to such a state of financial stress because of other factors, I mean, what's going on in the world, and Lord knows we may invade Iraq, and who knows how that's all going to play out. If indeed we have gotten to that point, and if as a result of that it is necessary to consider an impairment of contract, then I would suggest to you that the pension contract should not be the only one on the table. In other words, there may be hundreds, literally thousands of contracts out there, and if we have arrived at the point, and I personally don't believe we have, but again, I defer to your judgment, if we've arrived at that point, then I think there need to be many more contracts on the table because this is not the only contract or not the only contractual commitment which is causing strain on state and local governments. So impossibility is still there. It hasn't gone away, but I think it's going to be a difficult argument to make in this context.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Randall Eshmont and Bob Livingston, as long as we have 2004 open and work session, I know you guys wanted to put some things on the record before we move on to the invited testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters. I'm going to be as brief as I can. One of the things that I think with respect to the mortality tables that has not received a lot of attention is exactly what the concept of what particular type of mortality tables you may envision employing. One of the things that I would like to bring to your attention is the fact that as someone who represents firefighters and who is a firefighter, we do have concerns with the fact that their proposals that are potentially out there use a blended rate, meaning that they're going to use a portion of women as well as men. The reasons we have concern with that are of several reasons. The first is that the fact that my profession continues to be predominantly a male profession, albeit that we are making strides to be more diversified. The fact of the matter is, I think there's probably 90% of the career firefighters out of there are males. So by the fact that you're potentially going to adopt a blended rate, and knowing that females live longer than males, there's going to be a reduction, particularly for my people, with respect to potentials and how you do that. The other issue that I'd like to address on that is that the reality of it is, and hopefully at some point in time I won't be able to say this, but it's still, the fact of the matter is that firefighters still die at a younger age than general service employees. Some of the reasons for that certainly are because of the physical issues of our job. Certainly, I could bring studies in that show we have higher rates of cancer, higher rates of heart disease, and in fact, heart disease is still the number one cause of death for firefighters. Lung disorders, and also certainly the issue of infectious disease, certainly the propensity to contract hepatitis C and some of these other infectious disease do cause us concern. And so, even though Mr. Johnson may have a difficult time pinpointing within the police and fire units, specifically what is the difference comparatively speaking to general services, I think an articulate argument could be made that even if general service and police and fire mortalities for the state of Oregon are similar, when you combine that with what I've already mentioned and the fact that the healthy worker effect, which basically the healthy worker effect simply says is that for the most part, it's because of the jobs that police and firefighters do. One, you're younger when you do it. You're typically in better shape, and you have a better healthy life because of the standards that you have to in order to get into the workforce. And so one of the things that I think, just to wrap it up, is that I think you strongly need to consider what exactly those mortality tables are when you try to address that, and certainly we would be proponents of one that would be more reflective of a male mortality type table because of some of those things that I mentioned. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Brian DeLeichman. I'm representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Just to be extremely brief, Bob covered the main points. I did have a brief discussion with Steve Delaney from PERS prior to this hearing to try and determine whether or not they have the ability, or Mark Johnson would have the ability, to make a judgment on if you were to split police and fire out from general service, what the difference in the mortality experience for Oregon has been. And he indicated to me that he didn't believe that was, they were able to do that. That does trouble us, because we're obviously, if you're using a blended table, we have national studies that show very dramatically that police officers and firefighters die at a much younger age than general service. So if you're using, even under the current system or under a revision to the mortality table, you're using that same assumption that a police officer or a firefighter is dying at the same as general service or the blended table, then in fact those folks are not getting the full use of the accounts that they've accumulated to that point, and we would like to have that that explored as we go through the mortality table discussion.
Thank you. Questions?
One.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I haven't seen those studies. Could you provide me with studies so I could actually see what the basis was for them, when they were conducted, who they were conducted, what the pool was, and that kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we'd be happy to do that. I mean, obviously, the one concern, again, as I stated, is that Mark Johnson sets the Oregon experience based upon the Oregon experience, and these are all national studies, so we don't know how that compares to, obviously, their experience in Oregon. But the other thing that I would point out is, the other complication is there's a whole bunch of people in PNF in this state that are not police officers or firefighters, including legislators, and that, in fact, does skew the mortality rate, even if you look at the whole broad range of who's in PNF. That's not an accurate picture of police officers and firefighters' mortality in this state.
but we'll supply you with the national stuff that we have.
After the session, though, the legislators will be right in line with the police and fire as it relates to mortality, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, actually, I had a question, if I could.
Oh, did you?
Representative
McPherson?
What proportion of the active members of the PERS system are treated as public safety and therefore covered under that accrual rate as distinguished from the regular employee accrual rate?
Chuck Canope, Representative McPherson, perhaps that question is a more appropriate to the PERS staff itself. I don't know.
Okay.
In my discussions again with the PERS staff, we talked more about what information they have and how they could, in fact, come up with how they come up with the mortality tables. But we didn't talk in the line of the question that you're asking me. So,
thank you. I'm going to go into recess on the 2004 work session, and then I'm going to open a public hearing for the purposes of invited testimony today. Some of the employer groups wanted to bring forward, I guess it's not a bill yet, but it will be a bill. And so I think Bill Gary was going to come up. Bill, are you here? There he is. And introduce some folks and talk about their legislative concept, I guess, for now. I understand it's in the bottleneck of grafting currently, and will be available in the not too distant future, apparently, but not today. So, the reason none of you saw the 2003 on our schedule is because it technically currently doesn't exist, but will shortly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Bill Gary, an attorney in private practice with the law firm of Harang Long, Gary Rudnick. And I appreciate the chair's indulgence in permitting us time on your agenda today to talk about what will become House Bill 2003. It is, as you indicated, Mr. Chair, in the Legislative Council process. We're hoping it will be available for your consideration of introduction very shortly. As a preliminary matter, if I may, I will say that I do not intend to respond to Mr. Hartman's response to my response to his testimony. And obviously I have a response, I will submit something to you in writing. I think it may give you a flavor of why it took us 3 years to get the City of Eugene case out of the circuit court, that there is so much that both of us have to say on these issues. The bill that we're here to talk to you about today, as I indicated, has not come out of Legislative Council yet. It is a bill that there are 13 separate requesters that this committee introduced the bill as a committee bill. The requesters include kind of slugger's row of business organizations, as well as organizations that represent local governments, Associated Oregon Counties, the League of Cities, the Oregon School Boards Association, Special Districts Association. What we hope to do today is to give you a overview of what the bill proposes to do. I intend to present that overview. I'm joined at the witness table by Chris Dudley from the Oregon School Boards Association, who's seated to my right, by Mike Saltzgiver from the Portland Business Alliance, who's hiding behind me, and by Steve Manton from the City of Portland, who each of whom will have brief comments to offer concerning the bill. In terms of what we have been able to provide you, we have submitted for the committee's consideration written testimony from me, which I will not read, that describes the bill and why we think the bill is worthy of your consideration. There also is a document that is headed backgrounder that gives a summary of the bill lists on the last page of the backgrounder the persons and entities requesting that the bill be introduced. And then also in the same materials is a document called the PERS Reform and Stabilization Act, House Bill 2003, that shows side by side the standards that Governor Kulongoski set in his remarks last month about what a PERS reform bill would need to do and the attributes of the proposed bill to demonstrate, we think, that in every way the bill proposal meets the standards as set forth by the governor. We also have provided you with a draft of the bill that was prepared by my office. I caution you that this bill has not been through legislative council. Obviously, there will be stylistic changes in the bill as it comes to you, but I hope and trust that the substance of the bill will remain as it is set forth in the draft. One other preliminary comment before I turn to the provisions of the bill and how we got here. House Bill 2003 is, by design, an omnibus bill. It accomplishes a number of reforms to PERS, and it does so by addressing several different areas of concern, both the need to remedy what the circuit court concluded were past unlawful actions that had an effect of driving up benefits, a structural change to the system that will help us to control costs in the future, and changes in governance that that we think warrant the committee's attention as well. Many of the provisions in the bill are covered by other bills that you have or will consider. We recognize that, there are differences in the approach in some respects, but we included them because of our belief that it is, at the end of the day, appropriate for the Legislative Assembly to act in a comprehensive manner rather than on a more piecemeal basis. And part of the reason that we believe that's appropriate is because of, when you're operating and legislating in this area, there is the law of unintended consequences. The PERS statutes have been described as an old house that has been added onto and remodeled over the years as each legislature successively made changes to the bill, and we haven't always been as good as we ought to have been, either as interested stakeholders or as legislators, in foreseeing the effect of the changes that are made. We think that it is easier to do so if you look at the total body of changes to be made at one time. And in a related way, if the objective here is to achieve reform that actually saves money, it is important to recognize that when you ask the actuary to do a fiscal impact analysis of a proposal, those proposals can interact with one another in ways that change the outcomes depending on what the various components of the bill are. And so we think before final action is taken and something is sent on to the governor, we would urge the committee to think in terms of acting in a comprehensive manner. Let me turn to the bottom line from our standpoint, which is the cost savings to be realized from adoption of House Bill 2003. On the backgrounder and the last page is a balance sheet that has several different columns. The first column is headed 2001 Actuarial Valuation. This evaluation that you have before you was prepared by Mark Johnson, the PERS actuary, and it looks at the impacts of the bill compared to the 2001 actuarial valuation. Now, Mr. Johnson would point out to you, if you were here, that the 2001 valuation is the last comprehensive information we have about where PERS stands, but we know, because of investment losses in 2000, 2001, 2002, and so far in 2003, that the hole that we're in is much deeper than is reflected in these numbers. it nevertheless is an appropriate point of comparison because the savings are real off of the 2001 valuation. And while the numbers may not be as promising when you look at them relative to where we end up after the next valuation, the proportional savings will be the same. And I just want to call your attention to the number that is listed under the 2001 actuarial valuation for unfunded actuarial liability. It shows a $5.6 billion unfunded actuarial liability. You've all heard figures as high as $15 billion that are estimates of where that number is going if nothing is done to correct it. If you look over at the far right-hand column, combined impact of proposal, you will see that if the bill becomes law, the unfunded actuarial liability becomes $667.4 million, a substantial sum of money, but also a substantial improvement from where we were at in 2001. If you move to the bottom of the page, the adjusted total, average total rate under the 2001 valuation shows 22.48%. That is the estimated cost of the system overall, including both the employer contributions and the employee contributions, as of the 2001 actuarial valuation. And this morning at their meeting, the PERS board voted to issue new rate orders that will increase employer contribution rates to reflect this 22.48% cost number. If you look at the right-hand column, if this bill becomes law, the total cost falls to 12.65%, a saving of 9.83% of payroll. As a rough rule of thumb, a percentage of payroll statewide equals about $64 million. This bill would save $614.8 million per year from the cost of PERS when it is implemented. And my understanding is about 60% of that total is comprised of the state's share and the school district share. How did we get to a savings that is so significant? Well, first of all, let me tell you what this bill does not do. This bill does not take any money out of any member's account. It does not reduce account balances by reallocating, for example, the 1999 earnings allocation when PERS gave Tier 1 members 20%, and as Judge Lipscomb has ordered the PERS board to do. Neither does this bill, with one small exception, reduce any retired PERS members' benefit below what it is today. Now, in order for us to come forward with a proposal such as this, we began by identifying what were the primary causes of the hole that we find ourselves in. And the first is a primary driver of escalating costs from a structural standpoint, as all of you are by now aware, is the money match benefit. 95% of PERS members retire under the money match currently. It's expected that that will continue. By definition, someone who retires under the money match retires with a benefit that is higher than they would receive under the full formula. Otherwise, they would retire under the full formula. The money match was never intended to be the primary benefit for PERS members, and in fact, it was never even intended to be available to current employees. Prior to 1967, from 1953 to 1967, PERS was what is known generally as a money purchase plan. Employees put up a certain percentage of their payroll, employers put up an equal amount of percentage of their salary, and the employee got whatever that earned at the end of their career. In 1967, this body adopted a formula called the pension plus annuity formula, still in the books for people who were employed at the time that it was adopted. That is a formula that gives the member an annuity based on their account balance and a formula pension that is the employer's side of the contribution. When that was adopted in 1967, it was intended to replace the money purchase plan that existed beforehand. In 1969, the PERS staff came to the legislature and told them that an error had been made in 1967 because some long-term employees would receive a higher pension under the old money purchase plan than they would receive under the new pension plus annuity. And at the request of the PERS board, the legislature corrected that by inserting what is now the money match benefit. The legislative history is crystal clear that in doing so, they intended to protect the accrued interests of current employees who fared better under a money match than they did under the pension plus annuity. Nevertheless, and the pension and the money match continued sort of as a time bomb sitting in the statutes for the next 20 or 25 years. As recently as 1995, if you open up the PERS manual that describes to members what their benefit would be, it describes the full formula pension. It mentions nothing about the money match. A combination of actions taken by the board over time, together with other factors, had the effect of pushing money match to the point where it became the generous benefit that it is in many cases today. Those actions by the board would not have mattered very much if we were applying a full formula, but in the context of a money match benefit, they had economically catastrophic consequences. You've already heard testimony about actuarial factors. Actuarial factors only matter under the money match for calculation of the main benefit, and the effect of paying people off of outdated mortality tables is to increase the cost. In addition to that, since 1978, the PERS board has failed to maintain reserves that are mandated by statute, including a contingency reserve. They put no money in the contingency reserve since 1978, apparently because the board concluded that it wasn't necessary. And then they also failed to adequately maintain other reserves, such as the gain-loss reserve. That led, in turn, to imprudent crediting, particularly of Tier 1 member accounts, which drove up account balances. In 1995, PERS credited Tier 1 member accounts with 12.5%. 1996, 21%. 1997, 18.7%. 1998, 14.1%. 1999, 20%. Those all represented the unrealized gains that the fund had seen. But as you know, the fund is assumed to earn 8% over time, and Tier 1 members have a right to receive at least 8% in every year. In 2000, when the fund earned 0.63%, and in 2001, when the fund earned negative 7.17%, Tier 1 members were credited with 8% in each year. So that not only were those prior allocations to their accounts locked in, but they continued to grow even as the assets of the fund were lost in investment losses. In addition, and finally, the PERS board over the years has improperly calculated the variable match for participants in the variable plan in a way that has dramatically increased the benefits that those members received compared to what the law requires. This bill addresses the correction of past mistakes by doing two things. First, it rewrites and clarifies the reserving statutes, and it directs the PERS board to do what the law has always required it to do with respect to reserving practices, calculation of benefits, use of mortality tables, and so forth. The PERS actuary has estimated that the cost to the taxpayers of the erroneous benefits that have been paid, as found by Judge Lipscomb, the cost of those errors alone is approximately $3.1 billion. Now, Governor Kulongoski gave us a pretty tall charge when he said, I want to fix this problem and I don't want to take money out of member accounts and I don't want to reduce benefits to members who have already retired. We have a proposal in this bill that we think goes as far as one can go without breaching those two standards to recover the cost associated with the errors of the past. The first thing that the bill would do is create a deficit account within PERS. It would be about $3.1 billion. And the bill provides that that deficit would be paid over some amortization period, probably in the neighborhood of 15 years, out of future earnings. The effect of paying those costs out of future earnings is threefold. Number one, obviously, it reduces the amount of net earnings that are available for crediting to other accounts, including member accounts, and coincidentally also including employer accounts. Number two, the PERS actuary has indicated in his analysis that because the assumed interest rate that he calculates is based upon earnings net of expenses, treating this $3.1 billion item as an expense would cause the actuary to revise his assumed earnings rate, and that assumed earnings rate would fall to somewhere between 7 and 8%, depending on the amortization period. And thirdly, it means that the employers, consistent with Judge Lipscomb's opinion, would not be charged increased rates in order to pay for benefits that that are in excess of what the law provides, that would be earned over time by the fund's future earnings. One other provision that is included in the bill is to deal with the fairness issue, and it has little to do with contract rights, but what's the right thing to do? And it was the conclusion of the group that worked on this that at the end of the day, it is not fair to completely balance or solve the problem on the backs of employees who are early in their career or who have yet to begin their career as public employees when benefits are being paid out in an amount that is greater than the law provides to people who have retired. This bill provides that if someone retired subsequent to 1996, which is as far back as Judge Lipscomb's decision would go for some purposes, then they would not receive a annual cost of living adjustment as provided in statute until their benefit with the cost of living adjustment catches up to the level that they're actually being paid. Some of you who are familiar with employment law would think of that as a red circle approach that is done with regard to salaries in many instances. In addition to the corrections to the of the PERS board's actions, the centerpiece of this bill is a provision that would, over the next 2 years, eliminate the requirement that employees contribute 6% of their income to the PERS retirement system. The bill provides that as of July 1, 03, the contribution would fall to 3%, and as of July 1, 04, it would fall to 0%. You heard me right. The proposal is that employers would assume 100% of the cost of the system. And one might think that that is counterintuitive as a proposal that would save money. The reason that that proposal saves money is because it slows the growth of member accounts, which drives the money match benefit. And over time, the money match benefit becomes a less significant component of the retirement plan. Reduction is gradual. What that means is that for people who are very close to retirement, within 5 years of retirement, the impact of eliminating employee contributions would be negligible. The reason for that is because, as you all know, at a certain point, account balances grow to the point where the earnings on the account balance is far more significant than the contributions as a percentage of payroll. People who are 10 years away from retirement would see a reduction in their anticipated benefit, but they would still retire, in most cases, under the money match, which means that they would still receive a benefit higher than the full formula benefit, albeit lower than the actuary currently projects that they would receive. Persons who are 10 years, 20 years or more away from retirement in all likelihood would never develop account balances sufficiently large enough to trigger the money match. They would retire under the full formula benefit that provides the level of replacement income that the legislature always intended for PERS to provide. And finally, people who join the system after this bill becomes law would never have an account balance. For them, PERS would be a pure defined benefit plan, and they would retire under the formula that the legislature has provided. Even though this proposal puts the entire cost of the system on the backs of the employer, it saves money, and I want to hasten to point out it saves money even if, at the end of the day, all of that 6% that employees were previously paying into the system becomes salary that they keep. Now, that isn't the way the bill is structured, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but even then, this saves substantial money. And this is the counterintuitive part of the proposal. The reason that you save money, even if you give the employees the full 6%, is because it costs much more than a matching dollar whenever you put that 6% into the system. For every dollar that is in a member's account, it costs employers $1.40. Because of a whole host of factors that drive up the costs. Our proposal provides, as you know, a lot of people have referred to this proposal as the pickup proposal, and as you all know, there's a proposal, there's a provision in the statutes that allows participating public employers to agree to pay the employee's 6% contribution. That is an agreement that is reached for the most part with respect to covered employees anyway, at the bargaining table. The state of Oregon picks up the contribution, some local employers and school boards pick up the contribution, and some don't. Circumstances vary from employer to employer depending on what their agreement with their employees is. Therefore, this bill provides that upon passage, those agreements would be reopened for the sole purpose of negotiating what is to be done with the 6%. I'll give you two quick examples. Lane County does not pick up the employee contribution. And so, unless there is some contrary agreement, the effect of this is that on July 1 of 04, the employees would have a net 6% increase in their pay package because they no longer would have to pay the 6% to PERS. Under the bill, Lane County would be allowed to sit down with the unions that represent its employees and negotiate what is to be done with that 6%. On the other hand, Multnomah County does pick up the contribution, and their agreements, as I understand it, have a provision in them that in the event that Multnomah County is not continuing to pay the 6%, then employees automatically get a 6% raise. That, too, would be subject to negotiation between the employees and the employers. There are a lot of things that I think possibilities that are that arise by virtue of eliminating the employee contribution. That money could be redirected, or some portion of it could be redirected into a defined contribution plan, a 401k type provision. It could be used to create a medical savings account to pay for medical expenses upon retirement. It could go into raises. It could go to save jobs that might otherwise be lost by virtue of the dire financial straits that many public employers find themselves in. That's an overview of what the bill does. I said it does three things. I've only talked about two. The other thing that it does deals with governance. If, like a bill that you've already acted on, would reduce the size of the board to 5. It would provide the chair, would be appointed by the governor, and it also provides for independent legal counsel outside of the Department of Justice. I can respond to questions. Perhaps it would be more efficient to let my colleagues make their statements first, as the chair wishes.
Sure. I think we'll go ahead and let the others at the dais speak. And write down your questions, colleagues, if you have them, and we'll ask them once both these gentlemen are done.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Dudley. I'm the executive director of the Oregon School Boards Association, 1201 Court Street, Northeast in Salem, Oregon. The association is a voluntary association of locally elected board members from community colleges, school districts, and education service districts. We represent 197 school district boards, 17 community college boards, and 21 education service district boards. All of our employees are covered by its ERS system. School districts and education service districts are treated as a single employer under the statutes, and that's been a real advantage in terms of small employers and mobility, but it's also had its disadvantages in terms of some other people make decisions for the employer in terms of coverages, etc. But overall, it's been a good system, if you will, for our employees and consistent. However, this bill is important to us because this issue now is a very big issue for us. We're engaged now in discussion with our publics about the funding in schools and the problems we've got under the current tax structure. We've got insurance rate increases that are hard to accommodate, and we've got a PERS system that's working like Pac-Man. It's eating everything in sight. And so until we deal with these things as good stewards of the public dollar, we don't think we can get to the broader discussion, if you will, about how we're going to adequately fund school districts in the long term. And so this is a very important issue to us from that kind of public policy standpoint. We also have a lot at stake just in plain dollars. Right now we're at 12.73% of salary for our employees, and if you do the 6% pickup, it's 18.73% for PERS alone. We're scheduled to go up to 18.58% for the employer contribution, and if you do the 6% pickup, we're at 24.58% of salary as of July 1. That's before Social Security. You add Social Security in, we're over 30% on a dollar of salary to pay people not to stay and working for you. And it just doesn't make very much sense. And it's eating us alive. The third reason I think you ought to look at this bill really carefully and approve it is that it's comprehensive. It deals with a governance issue. It deals not only with a governance issue in terms of the board and size and discretion. It deals with outside counsel that's not covered. It also deals with the cost issues and the benefits issues. It does it in a transitional approach basis. We're moving to an affordable plan. We're moving an affordable plan in a fair way in terms of those people who have been in the system for a long time. There's a minimum effect on them. Those in mid-career have a moderate effect and a chance to accommodate, and those that are just starting out will be under a system that's virtually what the system was originally designed to be. So, as I listened to Bill Gary explain the money match originally, this actually moves the money match to do exactly what the original one did, which is protect the investment of certain individuals and not reduce their benefits while we transition to what is basically a fully employer-paid defined benefit plan that is adequate and very reasonable in terms of what you find in the private sector and affordable. Now, I don't think anyone should be misled that this is going to reduce our costs right now, because under the circumstance we're in right now, as long as the earnings of the fund don't match the assumed earnings rate, employers pay the difference. Okay, and while the stock market's where it is, we're still going to have moderate increases in our employer contribution rates, even if this passes. What it does is ameliorate that terrible mountain we have in front of us of the unfunded actuarial liability that we're going to have to amortize over a 28-year period. And so, from our standpoint, this is a very important issue for us from a public policy standpoint. It's a financially very important issue for us, and it gives us a stable, adequate retirement system for our employees into the future.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today on HB 2003. For the record, I'm Steve Manton, Pension Systems Manager for the City of Portland Bureau of Management and Finance. Today I'm speaking not only for the City of Portland, but for the other employers who joined together in a legal effort to challenge the rate orders developed by the Public Employees Retirement System. Our group, Lane and Multnomah Counties, Portland, Eugene, Roseburg, and Huntington, and Rogue River Irrigation District and Canby Utility District, was successful in seeking redress from the Marion County Circuit Court. The decision by Judge Lipscomb is the basis for the components of this bill. The judge's decision, however, even if fully implemented, does not provide enough relief from the ongoing growth of PERS liabilities. With this in mind, we've added to the HB 2003 the provision to restrain growth of PERS liabilities by stopping employee contributions. Along with the immediate implementation of actuarial equivalency factors and the recouping of excess interest crediting, we believe this will bring a measure of balance to the system and immediate savings to employers. We urge the committee to pass this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Salzgiver. I am State Government Affairs Manager for the Portland Business Alliance. The Alliance is the creation of the merger of the Portland Metropolitan Area Chamber of Commerce and the Association for Portland Progress, and came into being in July of this year. We represent over 1,250 members in the Portland metropolitan area, both private and public members. I'll try to be very brief, and I want to echo in some degree Mr. Dudley's comments, but at the Alliance we have a number of public policy objectives for this legislative session. Overall, our mission is to contribute to solutions which resolve many of Oregon's pressing public policy issues, whether they're in the budget area, economic development, education, transportation, natural resources, or other issue areas. We want to help you find solutions that get Oregon's fiscal problems under control and move the state back to a position of economic health and growth. One aspect of what we're trying to do is to help identify and control cost drivers which contribute to the budget problems that we have. And we believe that the PERS situation is perhaps the largest and most pressing of those problems. That, together with health care costs, as you have heard, contribute large sums to each of the public agency budgets and are a direct threat to long-term budget health and stability. On a personal note, in the mid to late 90s and into 2001, I served in my community as a school board member and for 2 years as chair in the Centennial School District 28J. And I remember in 1996, during a budget briefing that we received, we began to see the costs of the PERS and retirement and health care programs contributing to our budget growth in such a way that caused a number of us some concern. And as those costs began to escalate in the late 90s, the district found itself in a situation where it was increasingly difficult to meet classroom and program needs and still meet the needs of our employees based on those contracts. They imposed very serious pressure on the district's ability to meet their educational mission, and as we have seen today, we are in a very serious crisis with respect to education in this state. A co-equal public policy objective for us this year is to help contribute to a strong educational system. We believe that one of the ways that you will do this is to help get PERS and program reformed, restructured, and its costs under control. We believe that the bill that Mr. Gary has outlined is a sound, a reasonable, extremely well thought through proposal. It is equitable and it's fair, and it helps address in an immediate way this state's most difficult public policy challenge. We urge the committee's earliest consideration and action on it, and we would encourage the legislature to adopt it as soon as possible. Thank you. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Mr. McPherson.
I want to focus to begin with, and I think I'll direct the question to Mr. Gary, but he can pass it on to others if there's somebody who's more appropriate to respond. The funding of the deficit account, you mentioned that, if I understood it right, that would involve then committing a portion of earnings that would otherwise be credited to member accounts and to employer accounts. And if I understood correctly something you said, would also affect the assumed interest rate the actuary is assuming in the funding of the system. And so my question is, would that then negatively affect the contribution rates required across the whole system from employers, because they would be then required to fund at a higher rate because their contributions are not assumed to earn as much?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, it's an excellent question. As you know, the assumed earnings rate in most plans would would have that effect. That is, if you assume that the fund is only going to earn 6%, then employers have to pay that much more to make up the difference between 6 and 8%. And in fact, that is one effect on a short-term basis that the proposal would have. However, the actuarial analysis shows that the impact, the spike in rates that would occur by a reduction in the assumed earnings rate is overwhelmed by the savings in expected future benefits by virtue of the fact that if the actuary concludes that the fund is going to earn 7%, then the member tier one member accounts would be credited 7% in those years when earnings are 7% or less rather than 8%. And so overall it produces a savings. And of course, at the end of the analysis, what the actuary forecasts the fund will earn is insignificant compared to what the fund actually earns. And as I think it was Mr. Salzgiver indicated, or perhaps Mr. Dudley, the fact of the matter is that under this bill, employer costs will continue to rise as long as the stock market underperforms the actuary's forecasted assumed earnings rate. In that sense, the risk of a poor performing market continues to be 100% on the employers under this proposal.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Then, with respect to the estimated actuarial impact that's summarized on this one page that was in the materials we were given, do those figures then reflect the effects of a reduction in the assumed interest rate? Is that netting that effect?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that's my understanding, they do. And there's a more detailed analysis that the actuary has provided, which I'll be happy to provide to you and the members of the committee, that explains the assumptions, the impact of this proposal on his assumed earnings rate assumption.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I have several other questions I want to explore, but I think I might want to defer to other members of the committee who might want to pursue theirs, and I can...
Yeah, I have a couple of questions, and Representative Nolan does as well. Looks like Representative Barker... Oh, no, you're just... Okay. On this last page, I guess it is, or maybe second to last page, under attributes of House Bill 2003, you talked about a defined benefit plan. I assume that you're not talking about a new plan, because my understanding is this bill doesn't contain a new plan.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. This bill does not include a new plan, and I should point out that many of the requesters who support this bill are of the view that even when this bill becomes law, the legislature should take the next step of adopting a successor plan. There are others among my colleagues who believe that the effect of this bill on a going forward basis is to convert the current system into a fairly standard garden variety defined benefit plan, and so it at least allows the legislature time to move in a planful way toward the adoption of a successor system.
Thank you. As it relates to employers who have made lump sum payments on their unfunded liability, does this bill do anything to protect them or address their issue?
The numbers that, Mr. Chair, the numbers that I presented to you are system-wide savings, and the impact on individual employers will vary depending upon circumstances, such as whether they have paid down their unfunded actuarial liability. Those are details that are not specifically addressed in the bill, but many of my clients, most notably Eugene, Lane County, Portland, and Multnomah County, that made very substantial cash payments into the system, are very attentive to the fact that their rates should reflect that. And we assume that the impact would be, when you lower the overall projected costs, that many of those employers may find themselves in a unfunded actuarial surplus position as opposed to a liability position.
Thank you. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question of Mr. Salzgiver and then one of Mr. Dudley, if I might.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Salzgiver, since you're bringing us the benefit of some business perspective, I appreciate that. certainly the unfunded liability that the PERS pension system faces is substantial and catches our attention, but it's hardly unique in the world of pension systems around the country, both public and private. So my question is whether you have any members who have defined benefits plans that, in light of the recent stock market performance, don't have unfunded actuarial liabilities.
Chair Knope, Representative Nolan, I don't have that information directly at hand. It is possible that as a result of recent conditions that those situations have come to be. But in this case, we are focused here on a system that is supported by taxpayer dollars and in its entirety, and so we have to focus on it from the standpoint of what is good public policy. We believe this bill takes care of that problem. It certainly, based on the spreadsheet data that we've seen, addresses the unfunded liability problem in a very rapid way and in a very responsible way. As far as the private company information is concerned, we can try to get that for you as soon as possible.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I might address Mr. Dudley. Thanks. I'm particularly interested, Mr. Dudley, in the effect on the employees of the school districts, and you alluded to that earlier. Do you know what the retirement rate in your members' employees is recently compared with in prior years?
Mr. Chair?
We've heard about a rush to the door, and I wanted to know if you could substantiate that.
Representative Nolan, I can't give you specific figures on that. I can go check. And it's kind of confusing in the situation school districts are in now, because actually an early retirement is cheaper than a reduction in force. If you've got a situation where you can't sustain your current program level, you're much better off encouraging someone who's going to go out on a PERS retirement early than you are to have someone go out on unemployment. And so I think the whole the actual circumstance in school districts may be a little bit clouded or skewed by the current fiscal circumstance. I do know from talking to school administrators that they are saying they're experiencing a spike in the number of people who are going to decide to leave who are 58 years or more in the system, or 58 years old and about 30 years in the system.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
In that circumstance, and I understand that there may be some cost savings, or at least short-term cost savings, but in that situation, you don't get to choose who leaves and who stays. And I have heard in other committees testimony that school districts face a fairly daunting recruiting challenge, particularly for some specialties in teaching, English as a second language, foreign language, and that sort of thing. I wonder if you could address how your bill would positively or negatively impact your ability to recruit those positions. If we can't fill them now, how will we be able to attract the kind of talent into those positions if we lower the benefits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, when I went to work for the Oregon School Boards Association as a 27-year-old master's degree person looking for a profession, I didn't pay much attention to what I was going to get in retirement. As a matter of fact, I am a PERS Tier 1 covered employee, and I'm going to have a lot more money than I ever dreamed I was going to have under the system. This current system we have, I don't think changing it to one that looks very much like a private sector defined benefit plan for the people coming out of college is going to be any kind of deterrent to employment. I think on the opposite side of that, this plan is so good that it's sucking people out before they are ready to retire because of the ability to leave and make more money retired on PERS than they can in a current paid position. And I think whatever system we move to should not do that. I think that's wrong, and it's expensive, and I don't think it can sustain itself.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, could I add something to that question real quick?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nolan, looking at it also from the perspective of a district trying to hire and be competitive in hiring the best teachers and staff that it can find, what we found was the largest deterrent right now to hiring in any district in this state is the state's fiscal problem. And we are hearing time and time again, my wife works in the Centennial District, and I know a number of staff who are discussing leaving the state for other opportunities, primarily because they do not have confidence that the school system is going to be funded in a stable and predictable manner going forward. So to us, the larger public policy question really is how to get the state's financial footing back under it so that schools and other public services can be funded in a manner that is strong and predictable for the future.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative McPherson.
Mr. Gary, the table that, again, that's summarizing the numbers refers to a change to current actuarial equivalency factors, that is mortality table being the driving force, that's full and immediate, resulting in a reduction of 2.21% in the employer rate. As of what date would the transition occur that that number is based on, and could you describe full and immediate what the impact would be on retirees?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the bill provides that actuarial factors, current actuarial factors, will be applied effective January 1, 2003, which was the date that Governor Kulongoski proposed, and it provides that it will apply actuarial factors fully and immediately, meaning without any kind of a look back provision. So this is a proposal that does not, other than people who have retired since the first of the year, does not go back to take money out of their accounts, but implements the actuarial factors immediately. And the bill itself does not address questions about what actuarial factors will be applied, such as speaking to some of the testimony you heard earlier about blended tables versus tables that take into account police and fire mortality and so forth. That is not the focus of the bill. The bill merely directs that the tables be current tables and leaves to the actuary in the first instance and the board the decision about what tables it will apply.
Any questions, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
There is also included on the chart a column that's labeled Section 26 Adjustment, and I may have been wool gathering at the wrong moment, but I didn't hear an explanation of that column and the numbers, and I'd say the bottom line number and its effect on employer rates is nearly as significant as the change in mortality tables.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the Section 26 adjustment is the term that the actuary used to describe the deficit account that I described. It's been referred to by others as the Lipscomb adjustment, I think in deference to Judge Lipscomb's abhorrence for that phrase. The actuary chose to refer to it by the section as it appears in the bill.
I see.
Okay.
That's all I have.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else? As long as we have invited public testimony, I'll invite anyone else who wants to testify on the proposal to come up. We still have some time left in committee. Is there anybody who wants to come up? Mr. Hartman. I'm shocked and surprised, but come
on. Can I just stay up here?
No, hopefully.
Hey, I'd like that, dueling attorneys.
But I'm taking my water.
Let's see if we had you both here for the next hour. I wonder how much that would cost.
Mr. Chairman, Greg Hartman for the record. I will say before your committee hearing today, I asked Bill whether we should call this the Bill and Greg Show or the Greg and Bill Show, and he was kind enough to defer and suggest we could do Greg and Bill, so I guess that's how we'll be referred to from now on. I've seen the bill for the first time a few minutes before the hearing, so I'm not going to give you any extended comments on although I'm familiar with the concepts. I would like to give you two thoughts. Number one, to the extent that this bill builds on what Judge Lipscomb did, it is dependent on whether Judge Lipscomb got it right. Because if Judge Lipscomb did not get it right, in other words, if ultimately at the end of the day Judge Lipscomb has determined that he was mistaken in his analysis, then the portion of the bill based on Judge Lipscomb will fall with it. Because if, and let me make sure I say this the way I want to say it, if in fact Judge Lipscomb erred in his analysis of the law, and the law in fact meant what Peirce believed it meant all those years, and if the legislature then changes the law, you're right back into the old question of whether you are violating contracts. So I would simply caution you to say that as you think about this, you are building this edifice on what may be a decision which I believe is subject to challenge and will be challenged and will be overturned. I would urge you to get advice from your own counsel rather than from Mr. Gary or myself on that issue. The second thing I wanted to comment on, and this really relates to the eliminating the 6% pickup, one of the things that we've enjoyed really for the last 30 years in the state of Oregon is relatively peaceful and good labor relations. If I remember correctly, and I may be a year or two off, but the public sector collective bargaining bill was passed in the early 70s, so we've had about 30 years at this point, maybe a few years more, of experience under that bill. And I think if you think back over the last 30 years, there have maybe been a half a dozen strikes that were enough to cause anybody to take note of them. So we've had a period of tranquility, if you will, in bargaining relations. I'm struck by some of the comments that were made because there seems to be a complete lack of understanding of what the impact of the adoption of this bill would have on the workplace. It will cause the best and the brightest to consider leaving the state. It will make it more difficult to recruit for those positions that we cannot recruit. And I say that for a couple of reasons, because first of all, it significantly decreases what people believe their pension entitlement is to be. Now, maybe the court says that's okay. But nonetheless, the impression is going to be created out there that the Peirce pension promise doesn't amount to much. Because if this legislature can draw down the benefits by this amount, what's to prevent the next legislature or the legislature 4, 6, or 8 years down the road from drawing them down again because, for whatever reason, it's deemed to be the appropriate public policy? I think this will have a tremendous negative impact in the workplace, and I think the best way to highlight that is to look at the portion of the bill which says that the 6% will now be subject to negotiation. And let me back up and remind you how we got to a 6% pickup in virtually every workplace where it exists. The 6% pickup, and I may be off a year or two in my dates, but my recollection is the 6% pickup was first bargained in the state as a state matter in about 1979. And the reason it was bargained was because the year before, the Internal Revenue Code had changed the provisions of the code permitting a pickup and, in essence, allowing employees to fund the pension plan with pre-tax dollars. Now, when they did that, and again, if you remember back in the 70s, it was also a time of economic distress in the state of Oregon. That's when we were in the double-digit inflation years. The pickup became a win-win for employees and employers. Because the employee won because the 6% was now paid pre-tax. But the employer also won because this was recognized as money that was going into the plan, there was a savings in the amount of the FICA contribution that employers had to make. And so back then it was win-win. Everybody felt it was something that it was simply an opportunity given because the tax code had been amended. And I can reassure you it's been my uniform experience in every workplace that has done the pickup. It has been because people have given up a raise in lieu of receiving the pickup. Now what I hear is a suggestion that this raise that was given up in return for the pickup is now going to be sent back to the collective bargaining table. I will reassure you that every employee out there believes that that is their money. And it's money they've earned. It's part of their benefits package. And to suggest that they will now have to go back to the table and re-bargain it or recapture it in some sense, I think exacerbates the entire problem caused by this bill. I think from a workplace perspective, what's going to happen is that you are going to have a circumstance where workers all over the state feel that they have not been valued. They've not been valued twice because, number one, their pension is being cut, but number two, monies which they believe to be theirs, which I think is a reasonable belief given the circumstance, they're now going to be told you can re-bargain and try to get it back. You're talking about a double whammy which you're going to put on your workforce, and I think I cannot overestimate the negative impact that will have. You know, I was talking with someone the other day, and this is totally divorced from PERS, but I was talking with someone the other day, a colleague, an attorney, but not someone who practices in the area of labor relations, and he was asking me about what causes strikes. I mean, what causes strikes? You know, people often believe it's money. And I said, no, it really has been my experience that strikes happen when there is a lack of respect at the bargaining table. Now, there are other issues. There's money, there's pensions, there's health benefits. But the key issue, which I've uniformly seen when there is a work stoppage, is that there is a lack of respect between the bargaining parties. It develops for many, many different reasons. I think that when if the legislature were to go this route, that this, in fact, is a message of lack of respect, which is going to be received and treated that way by bargaining individuals all over the state. And so I caution you, as you think about this, to think about the broader impact of this. Does it save money? Obviously it saves money. Is it subject to legal challenge? I'll address that on another day. But I do want to remind you that you're dealing with a circumstance not only where you have individuals who are impacted, but where you have workplaces that are impacted. And I see this bill as having a tremendous negative impact. If I may point out one final thing, if you concede the fact that in fact the 6% is going to be paid to the employees, then this bill, despite the massive changes it makes in the system, has a rather modest savings, because instead of going from 22 to 12, which I think were the figures that Mr. Gary shared with us, in other words, from 22% down to 12%, of that 10%, 9-10% differential in there, I would suggest to you that 6% of that belongs to the employee. And so if you concede the fact that these are employee funds, the savings from this drastic change are really more in the range of 3 to 4%. That's a huge change to the system in order to capture a relatively modest savings in that rate. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions. I will provide a more detailed legal analysis and will, of course, return if you would like me to discuss those legal issues, but I will give you something in writing as well.
Greg, you mentioned or maybe speculated about how the Supreme Court might take up Lipscomb or any other case as it relates to that. And you indicated that with Lipscomb that you think that, I think you used the word something like you might be building on a case that ultimately might be overturned. But if the court looks at it in sort of the holistic way that you suggested they might, wouldn't you think that it would take up Lipscomb, maybe the 8% cap or the mortality tables or this bill and sort of rule on them all at the same time, and in essence saying if Lipscomb was right, then these bills might be remedies, but they might not be the entire remedy that the court could accept. I guess my point is this, and that is why shouldn't the legislature put bills before the court that have to do essentially with remedies as it relates to Lipscomb, as opposed to waiting a year, 2 years to get a decision on Lipscomb, even if we expedite that particular case? Why wouldn't we want to try to get some remedies, I guess for lack of a better word, for them at the same time that they're looking at
whether or not Lipscomb was right, just in case they should determine that he, in part, he was right, or maybe in full that he was.
Mr. Chairman, I made the comment earlier that I think at the end of the day that it is likely the courts will consider probably virtually all of these issues in some way together. Even if it doesn't end up in one case, I suspect it will arrive at the court at a time when, in fact, the court will have all of these issues in one way or another before it. I'm not necessarily suggesting to you that it is inappropriate for the legislature to work out an implementation scheme of Judge Lipscomb's opinion if you think that appropriate. What I am suggesting to you is two things. If Judge Lipscomb got it wrong, then presumably the scheme will fall along with Judge Lipscomb's erroneous decision. Number two, remember, and I made this point earlier, that Judge Lipscomb did not address remedies. And you recall the excerpt that I shared with the committee from our dialogue that took place in the court with Judge Lipscomb, that I don't believe that he addressed the issue of, you know, what do we do next? And quite properly so, because given the limited role of a court in this circumstance, it's appropriate to send it back to the administrative agency to make that decision and then for the court to review that. There's nothing, I'm not trying to discourage the legislature from thinking of remedies if you believe Judge Lipscomb got it right. But again, I'm encouraging you to get the best legal advice you can on that issue. I would be happy to share my many briefs with you, as Mr. Gary would, but I think it may be much more effective to hear from your own attorneys, because if you are going to build on Judge Lipscomb, and as I say, if it does turn out that there were errors in how he analyzed, then the whole scheme may at the end of the day come tumbling down.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
With the discussion that's ongoing, I just want to make certain that House Bill 2003 has a directive that any challenges would go straight to the Supreme Court.
Thank you. I don't know if that's in the bill.
Thank you.
Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler. I should have mentioned this earlier. The bill does provide for direct review, immediate and expedited review to the Supreme Court. It is my view that I think is shared by everyone that I've been working with on this legislation and litigation that, and I suspect that Mr. Hartman and I may actually agree on this, it is in no one's interest to have the litigation drag on for what could be another 2 or 3 years, leaving our public employees with massive uncertainty about where they stand. And for that reason, I think that what makes perfect sense is for the legislature to deal with the remedies to the problems that were identified by Judge Lipscomb. Now, Mr. Hartman will tell you he's going to win on appeal. I always say that when I lose in the trial court as well. And I'm going to tell you I think I'm going to win, and that's not very useful to you. One of us is going to win, or we're both going to win something. That'll be sorted out by the appellate court. But if we wait until the appellate court decides it, and you send it back to the Public Employees Retirement Board to implement whatever is left when the Supreme Court has spoken, we'll be back here next session and the session after without having made any significant headway. And so I think it's important that the committee act, as you suggested, Mr. Chair, and I would like to see these issues packaged and put before the Supreme Court so they can deal with them comprehensively, as I suggested that the legislature should. And I think it is entirely possible and appropriate that the Supreme Court take up the Lipscomb decision and any legislative actions, including actions designed to implement the Lipscomb decision, at the same time and as expeditiously as possible.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on the plan? Well, we do have one more hand back there. Come on up.
Mr. Chair, just a very quick observation. My name is Mike Forrest. I'm a public employee. And I retired on January 1st. And One quick observation. I noticed on the second, or actually third page of this, it says, one of those considerations is the effect on those who retire and through no fault of their own based their retirement decision on what they were told their retirement benefits would be. Drastically reducing their benefits now could have a profound impact on their lives. Well, isn't that exactly what making this effective on January 1st does? It literally comes back around behind those folks who made that decision based on what they thought they were going to have, retroactively, essentially, and changes their annuity. I don't know if anyone has any comment on that. I'd like to understand the language, which seems to be contradictory here. One part of it saying we'll make it effective on January 1, the other part saying we won't affect those who are currently retired. Well, those folks that retired on January 1st are currently retired. And there seems to, I'm not sure about the legality of it, but there's certainly a moral obligation for those who are actively or currently retired that you not come back now behind them and reduce their annuity. Because in good faith, they agreed on an amount with their retirement system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forrest. We're well aware of the January 1 issue, and we'll take the, I know the committee will take that under consideration. Yeah. Anyone else? Nope. All right. We'll close the public hearing on the invited testimony, and I believe that completes our agenda for today. Thursday, I believe we were going to deal with a small bill, small PERS bill for Representative Jensen.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And we had the successor plans. The successor plans I put on the agenda just for fun. And also 2004, we're hoping to have amendments by Thursday, at least to look at. I don't know that we'll act on them on Thursday. I suspect somebody might want to make a comment on them. So we'll at least hopefully have those available for Thursday. And in the meantime, we will stand in adjournment.
Michelle.